The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Patricia for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Time Magazine. Today's program is supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. That is gsuggsinsurance.com. For the next hour, I will be reading to you from Time Magazine's June 8, 2026 edition. The cover, as usual, is bordered in red with a narrow white inner border. The promoter is featured on the cover. This individual is dressed in black, what we can see of him from the shoulders up. His head is either bald or shaven. He's looking downward from the camera, neither smiling nor frowning. It's Dana White, whose image is on the cover of Time. Time is in large block capital lettering in dark gray. It's superimposed upon a slightly lighter gradient of gray. The date is June 8, 2026. I'll begin with a story entitled Former YouTube CEO Susan Wojcicki Died from lung cancer in 2024. Her family is trying to find out why. This is written by Alice Park, and it's under the health heading. There's a photo, well, there are several photos here of Wojcicki. That's Wojcicki. I apologize if I'm mispronouncing it. There is one family photo here. It's called a family snapshot. She was an executive, a mom of five, and an athlete. And she's pictured here with an adult male and four children. She had brown hair, Caucasian skin. Here she's smiling at the camera, as are the other subjects of the photograph. It started with pain in her hip. Susan Wojcicki, 54 at the time and CEO of YouTube, was a frequent runner and often swam in the company pool. Maybe it's just sore muscles, she thought, hoping the pain would resolve itself. She was in Europe attending a conference in the summer of 2022 and did not have time to give it much thought. When the pain persisted after she returned home to California, she decided to get an MRI. The scan said she had cancer. Stunned, Wojcicki called her primary care doctor, who was equally surprised and suggested she repeat the scan. She texted her sister Janet, a professor of pediatrics and epidemiology at the University of California, San Francisco, and told her the report showed bone cancer. She said, "I did it at a questionable radiology center because I wanted a quick MRI, so I'm going to repeat it," says Janet, who connected her sister to a radiologist friend. "Even then, I was joking with my friend that we didn't think it was possibly real. The second scan showed the same thing, and doctors believed the cancer found in Wojcicki's bones had spread there from another source. Sure enough, it was cancer, and it was metastatic," says Wojcicki's husband, Dennis Troper, a project management director at Google. "It was a bomb dropping in the room." Wojcicki had lung cancer, which kills more than 125,000 Americans each year, more than any other cancer. It was not on her radar. She had never been a smoker. She was healthy, active, and only in her early 50s. Yet people like Wojcicki, who do not fit the classic picture of someone with lung cancer, are increasingly developing the disease. While people with a smoking history make up the bulk of lung cancer cases and deaths, up to 20% of new diagnoses in the U.S. and worldwide are in non-smokers. By the time most of these cases are diagnosed, they have already advanced and spread to other organs, at which point the disease is difficult or often impossible to treat. Wojcicki decided not to reveal her diagnosis publicly and continued to work at YouTube until stepping down in early 2023. Behind the scenes, she and her sisters, Anne, who founded genetic testing company 23andMe, and Janet spent the next 2 years aggressively searching for answers to the questions Wojcicki asked herself over and over again. Why did this happen? Was there something she could have done to prevent this cancer? She tested her home for radon, the second leading cause of lung cancer behind smoking, and investigated air pollution patterns where she lived, but none yielded satisfactory answers. In the search for better treatments for her advanced disease, it became clear she was at the vanguard of an ignored group of people who were falling through the cracks of lung cancer care. After exploring and trying various cutting-edge therapies, including by joining clinical trials, testing experimental approaches, Wojcicki passed away in 2024. Several months after her death, her family posted a letter on YouTube that she had written, revealing her cancer journey and her intention to fight for better understanding and cures for this disease. Although Wojcicki died without knowing why she developed lung cancer, her family has not stopped looking for answers. In some of the first interviews about Wojcicki's cancer journey, they shared with Time and also with Good Morning America their decision to launch the Susan Wojcicki Foundation in order to fund efforts to diagnose lung cancer earlier, particularly for non-smokers, and change recommendations about who should be screened for the disease. Inspired by organizations such as the Michael J. Fox Foundation for Parkinson's disease and the Susan G. Komen Foundation for breast cancer, the family hopes to reframe how the public views lung cancer and change screening guidelines to include anyone, not just smokers, who might be at higher risk. If you look at non-smoking lung cancer, that is the fifth largest killer of all cancers, says Troper. It is a crisis. I met Wojcicki's sisters and husband at the family's farm, which is a short walk from their home in Los Altos Hills, California. The garden, beekeeping hives, and coop with more than a dozen egg-laying chickens were all Wojcicki's idea, a way to connect her five children to nature and part of Wojcicki's healthy lifestyle. In addition to exercising almost every day, she avoided sugar and ate naturally grown food as much as possible. Before the cancer diagnosis, the farm was where the Wojcicki sisters and their families would spend time together and gather for holidays. After, it became something of a headquarters for the family and the experts they invited over to figure out how to defeat her cancer. From day one, this was a project, says Anne, of the fight to save her sister's life, similar to the ones they would embark upon as children. I remember Susan calling us and saying, "You guys are in charge, so I can't deal with this, so I'm putting you guys in charge of solving this." A more qualified team could hardly have been assembled. The Wojcicki sisters are all such recognized leaders in the fields of science and technology that Mattel released Barbies in their likenesses in 2023 as part of its STEM series. The sisters grew up on the campus of Stanford University, where their father was a physics professor. and were always involved in projects together, from making and selling spice ropes to putting on magic shows. Their parents had always encouraged them to be independent thinkers and voice their opinions. "We grew up thinking it was a very negative thing not to speak your mind," says Janet. After learning about her sister's diagnosis, Anne called dozens of her contacts in the medical community from her years of building 23andMe, which declared bankruptcy as a commercial testing company in 2025, but now exists as a non-profit research organization, the 23andMe Research Institute, which Anne runs. She and Janet visited leading experts at the National Institutes of Health, who were not optimistic about Wojcicki's chances. Hearing this from experts on science's cutting edge was a watershed moment, Janet says. They said, "It looks really bad. You should go home and appreciate the time you have." But the sisters could not simply accept the dire prognosis. It goes back to our childhood and the mindset of being fearless and always stepping up, says Anne. "We had no issue calling up the heads of different institutions and saying, we have a problem. We were super aggressive advocates. We felt, this is a research problem. We can absolutely tackle this." During their driving their determination was the fast-changing world of cancer therapies, including breakthroughs in immune-based treatments and cell-based strategies known as CAR-T, which they were convinced would help their sister. The hope was that science is moving really rapidly, and it was almost like, in Susan's mind, she needed to stay alive long enough to capture some of those changes and innovation, says Anne. But we knew it was an uphill battle. The sisters soon learned lung cancer in young non-smokers is generally driven by specific genetic mutations that are not present in people who get smoking-related lung cancer. The good news is certain targeted therapies address those mutations and can extend survival, but these are most effective if started early in the disease before tumors spread to other organs. Even if the family could not do it in time to help their sister, they thought figuring out how to treat patients like her could be Wojcicki's legacy. Since before her diagnosis, Wojcicki and Troper had been funding cancer research projects through their joint philanthropic efforts. That work, combined with the projects Janet and Anne were pursuing to learn more about early-onset lung cancer, formed the seed of the Susan Wojcicki Foundation. The Troper and Wojcicki families have committed $150 million to launch the foundation. Melinda French Gates, Google, and Salesforce, whose CEO and co-founder Mark Benioff owns Time with his wife Lynn, have also provided significant contributions. In addition to funding research, the foundation is working closely with YouTube to raise awareness and change the public perception that lung cancer is solely a disease caused by smoking. Wojcicki had set the stage for such a health education role for YouTube years before she learned she had cancer. At a time when the platform was more known for promoting fluffy content, Wojcicki wanted to harness its influence for more substantive goals. She recruited Dr. Garth Graham, then at CVS Health, to head up a new initiative at YouTube to provide reliable, validated health information from qualified sources. The idea she had was that many people start their healthcare journeys on Google and YouTube, and video is a very important part of demystifying complex clinical topics, heart disease, diabetes, and a cancer diagnosis, says Graham. Graham is now designing a strategy that will make YouTube a resource for both the public and healthcare providers to learn about the risks of lung cancer among non-smokers and to inform them about the latest early detection developments as these advances occur. Google, which was started in Wojcicki's garage when she took a chance on two Stanford graduate students and where she was the 16th employee, is also working with the foundation to leverage AI-based analysis to accelerate the search for risk factors. AI gives us an historical opportunity to understand the why. Then we want to move into the what, Graham says. What do you do? How do we save more lives? How do we move forward on the issue of early detection? Lung cancer is among the few cancers for which screening is determined by a lifestyle choice, smoking, in addition to age. The stigma and guilt surrounding lung cancer caused by smoking means screening rates for the disease have always been and continue to remain low. Screening guidelines involve some complicated, non-intuitive math. People who should currently get screened for lung cancer include adults ages 50 to 80 who smoked the equivalent of a pack a day for 20 years, who currently smoke or have quit in the past 15 years. Even within this high-risk category, only about 18% to 20% of eligible people in the U.S. get the screening test, a low-dose CT scan. Breast, colon, and prostate cancers all have broad, age-based screening guidelines that have contributed to drops in deaths from these conditions. Wojcicki's sisters, as well as many lung cancer experts, argue it is time to broaden who is eligible for lung cancer screening because smoking captures only some of those at risk. In their quest to cure Wojcicki's cancer, the sisters recognized non-smokers who develop lung cancer are a massively understudied population. Scientists still did not know basic information about lung cancer in non-smokers, including the comprehensive range of genetic factors driving the disease. Just a month before her death, in July 2024, the sisters opened the lung cancer genetic study to uncover more of those genes. They have some hints from the few studies that have been done on non-smokers who develop the cancer. Those increasingly show the disease tends to disproportionately affect women, especially Asian women. It is a different demographic from Wojcicki's, but could provide clues about what other factors are driving lung cancer besides cigarettes. In 2021, researchers in Taiwan conducted a nationwide study at 17 hospitals of non-smokers with lung cancer risk factors like a family history of the disease, smoking, tuberculosis, and exposure to secondhand smoke or poorly ventilated cooking areas. The participants received a low-dose CT to look for lung cancer, and it was detected in 2.6% of the group. Encouragingly, 96% of these cases were detected at stage 0 or stage 1. Having a family history of lung cancer was the most significant risk factor of those studied, but the findings revealed how prevalent lung cancer was among people who did not smoke. Based on the results, health officials in Taiwan are now starting to screen more non-smokers there with those risk factors. So much of cancer care today is built around treating cancer after it occurs, rather than trying to detect it before it ravages the body. That's a mindset the Susan Wojcicki Foundation hopes to help change with the other initial grant to maintain another repository of blood samples from non-smokers. diagnosed with lung cancer. Dr. Sana Rauf, a radiation oncologist at Brown University Healthcare Institute, oversees the biobank and plans to scour samples for any molecular signals circulating in the blood that could distinguish them from those who do not develop cancer. This is the future of the war on cancer, she says. Such lab-based tests, if developed, could detect cancer far earlier. Right now, we are catching cancers in late stages in the majority of never smokers. Until that changes, it really felt to me, it does not matter what types of therapies we come up with because we are not addressing the root problem. If and when a test for picking up lung cancers early becomes available, the next challenge will be putting it in the hands of doctors where it can have the most impact. That's what Wojcicki's experience and vision at YouTube may become a critical factor. The education and awareness campaigns that the foundation plans for the platform will ideally prepare public health and healthcare professionals to advocate for lung cancer screening in a wider population once data support the practice is safe and effective. Many people are unaware of the impact lung cancer has, particularly on non-smokers, says Graham of YouTube Health. One of Susan's major visions was the idea of demystifying health and how to create healthcare information that is engaging and understandable. In this case, it is about how the general public should understand the risks around lung cancer, the warning signs, and the importance of screening. We also know a significant amount of clinicians come to YouTube for things like medication education, so it is an opportunity to educate the clinician community as well. The family's determined to finally answer the question that started it all: why did she get this? I remember Susan and I were in the hospital room, and she was very weak at that point, says Troper, becoming emotional at the memory. But she looked me in the eye and said, "Dennis, I don't care what you do when I'm not here, but do something meaningful." That article was slightly abbreviated. Oceans of Value. Next, under the heading Oceans, written by Justin Warland, a new ecosystem of companies is seeing the benefit in protecting the seas. Long before Pierre Poslier became an ocean entrepreneur, he was a plastics packaging engineer, turning fossil fuels into the materials needed to ship and sell cosmetics. But he knew there had to be a better way. After taking a break from the corporate world, he went back to school and launched into an experimental phase with his co-founder, Rodrigo Garcia Gonzalez. In a makeshift kitchen lab, they played around with food materials, trying to figure out how which would do the best job at mimicking plastics. Before long, they hit on a clue: imitation caviar, whose tiny membranes are made from seaweed, behaved in some ways like the packaging they were trying to invent. The company they founded in 2014, NOTPLA, NOTPLA, think not plastic, eventually expanded to build a product line including takeaway boxes, flexible films, rigid cutlery, and seaweed-based paper. Perhaps more importantly, it joined a growing ecosystem of startups committed to simultaneously making use of ocean resources and supporting their conservation. Inspired by companies like NOTPLA, the bank Standard Chartered in 2023 wrote a white paper on seaweed, declaring it an investable asset category. Suddenly, capital began to flow to seaweed startups. Today, more than $780 million has been invested in seaweed ventures, according to Ficonomy, a seaweed investment tracker. I see NotPLA as a good visible application to make the case for why it's worth spending more of our attention, brains, and dollars to the ocean space, says Poslier. There are a lot of solutions that are going to come from it in the future. Those solutions could not come fast enough. Oceans face continued and deepening threats from humans, from overfishing to plastic pollution. Coral reefs are dying at such a clip, scientists warn of irreversible loss. At the same time, oceans face the challenge of funding pullbacks from governments and nonprofits. The fractured geopolitical landscape also hampers efforts to forge international conservation agreements, even though some big successes like the High Seas Treaty have moved forward. But some environmental advocates, alongside a growing number of entrepreneurs and investors, are coming around to a realization. Position this threat slightly differently, and it actually becomes an opportunity. Last year, J.P. Morgan estimated the value of ocean-related activity, what it called the annual gross marine product, at $2.5 trillion annually. And it noted that ocean climate startups have raised over $5 billion in venture funding over the past decade. Most is early-stage financing, meaning there may be much more to come as companies mature. We need to continue growing an asset class that is not just for impact investors or philanthropic investors, but something people look at as part of the portfolio, says Philippe Cousteau, founder of the ocean tech company Voyage Regions and grandson of famed oceanographer Jacques Cousteau. This is easier said than done. Oceans are a new investment category. There's no guarantee enough investors will buy into the thesis to make it more than just a niche. Even if they do, it will be difficult to reach finance levels required to meet the scale of the challenge. Some ocean advocates say the private sector is poorly positioned to decide which practices are actually sustainable, much less protect oceans equitably. Though the first law of the sea dates to the Middle Ages, oceans are profoundly difficult to regulate and manage, especially as some governments abandon climate policy. Guy Standing, an economist whose book, The Blue Commons, is considered a landmark in ocean protection, describes it as a Wild West situation, as President Donald Trump disrupts seemingly any intergovernmental collaboration. It is in this gap that the private sector could determine the future. Its role in ocean protection may not have been the first best option, but with oceans in worsening shape and governments occupied with other priorities, it would be foolish to ignore the possibilities. This disconnect will come to a head in the coming years as the first ocean investment funds launched in the past decade amid urgent climate concern reach maturity. Successful companies that either raise more money or stand on their own will give investors a sense of true opportunity. As with any company, the key is creating a business model that someone else will pay for. That means solving a problem or creating an opportunity for customers, not just advancing ocean protection. When I go to speak to a textiles manufacturer, I am basically talking about how we are going to save them money, says Matter CEO Adam Root of the microplastics filter that cuts down on machinery, wear and tear. Standing The British labor economist is best known for his advocacy around universal basic income and calling for governments to play a more robust role guaranteeing citizens financial security. In his 2022 The Blue Commons, he challenges the concept that many ocean entrepreneurs and like-minded advocates have termed the blue economy. Oceans underpin all of human society, purely financially motivated efforts to protect them are, he argues, destined to fail. When we spoke in April, Standing expressed dismay at how collective efforts at ocean protection have stumbled or even moved in reverse. That said, he does not see private capital as the solution. I do not expect private equity to suddenly change and become pussycats and look after the environment, he told me. We need a new model to rescue the commons. It should not be controversial to say the private sector is not a replacement for public sector action, particularly when it comes to setting the rules of the road. Investors and entrepreneurs are experts at thinking about how to solve market problems, not about the broader ethical and political questions lurking under the surface. In most of my conversations with them, my question about how they define sustainability remained largely unanswered. Some things do seem beyond the pale to this group, thinking deep sea mining or offshore oil drilling. But the technologies they tend to tout, from offshore wind to carbon capture, come with their own trade-offs. In an ideal world, decisions about how best to balance these factors would be decided by governments after consulting with the best available science and considering the political, economic, and societal implications. Instead, official lack of consideration of the value of oceans may actually be slowing investment. Alfredo Giron, who heads the World Economic Forum's Ocean Action Agenda, says governments can play a key role by emphasizing the economic necessity of ocean protection. The big capital's not going to flow for real, he says, until the perception is changed. Big companies recognize the problem. They know their supply chains are threatened. They know many of their facilities face rising sea levels. But companies, by their very nature, are focused too narrowly to solve those global problems. We probably do need private sector money to flow into oceans, but the irony is the private sector may need government guidance just as much. Once the direction of travel is clear, the billions of dollars flowing into ventures today can turn into the trillions needed. Oceans of Value was written by Justin Warland, and this story is supported by a partnership with Outrider Foundation and Journalism Funding Partners. Time is solely responsible for the content. Time off. The time off opener here. And who's it by? Judy Berman. Red Wedding Season. Oh, this is a time off opener. Wedding season has barely started, and already this year I have witnessed enough catastrophic nuptials for a lifetime. I am not talking about tacky dresses or those ill-timed downpours that struck Alanis Morissette as ironic. The weddings I have in mind were soaked in tears, vomit, and other bodily fluids. Many involved violence or death of the soul, if not the flesh. One union was sealed by satanic rite alongside a pit of corpses. Another ended with lifeless bodies splayed out on the dance floor or slumped in their plates, their blood staining white, tablecloths crimson. I was not physically present for any of this, thankfully. These nightmare celebrations happen in shows and movies released within the past few months. Although there's horror in the mix, something very bad is going to happen, ready or not to, here I come. Their genre vary from the dystopian teen drama of The Testaments to the Victoriana of Wuthering Heights to the drama's black comedy. Not all concern heterosexual love, see Half Man. The common factor is a wedding so traumatic, any guest would be lucky to make it to the after party with body and sanity intact. Brutal fantasies like Game of Thrones' Red Wedding Massacre aside, this is not the way we typically see these sacred rituals depicted on screen. Think of the sumptuous spectacles of romance, family, and culture that make up the wedding movie canon. Monsoon Wedding, My Big Fat Greek Wedding, Crazy Rich Asians, The Wedding Banquet, The Best Man. Having a beloved couple, Jim and Pam, Corey and Topanga, exchange vows was once a foolproof way to juice TV ratings. To the generation now eyeing the altar, such ostentatious bliss may be a relic of more innocent times. But this year's Red Wedding season probably says less about their cynicism toward the institution of marriage than it does about broader anxieties regarding the future. The presumption that a woman's wedding should be the best day of her life has outlived many waves of feminism. But in Gilead, the totalitarian patriarchy that supplanted the U.S. in Margaret Atwood's The Handmaid's Tale, it's essentially the law. Hulu's The Testaments, an adaptation of the sequel, spends its first season among privileged pubescent girls training to be wives to powerful men. A ceremony joining one such character, Becca, Matea Conforti, to a young commander, Garth, Brad Alexander, is the centerpiece of the finale. It is a wrenching scene, not just because Becca's in love with her best friend Agnes, Chase Infinity, who is in love with Garth, but because it's interspersed with shots of the bride's mom being executed for the murder of the bride's dad. In fact, it was Becca who killed her father, a dentist who molested his teenage patients. Agnes is one of his victims. Gilead has always been a chilling vision of what America might become if right-wing theocrats seized absolute power and stripped women of all independence. A wedding in Gilead reveals the misogyny still latent in a ritual supposedly liberated from its origins as a transfer of property from father to husband. Evidence suggests progress toward equality within heterosexual marriage has not moved in a straight line since Women's Lib. Just this year, a 29-country study found Gen Z men are twice as likely as their baby boomer counterparts to believe wives should obey their husbands, which might help explain why the share of 12th graders who hope to marry someday decreased between 1993 and 2023, a trend almost entirely accounted for by girls' declining enthusiasm. The imagery of gendered oppression suffuses many of the fictional weddings resonating with younger viewers. In her fever dream, Wuthering Heights, Emerald Fennell opens a sequence in which Kathy, Margot Robbie, who's obsessed with Jacob Elordi's foundling Heathcliff, but must marry up, finally weds milquetoast Edgar, Shahzad Latif, with a close-up of the bride's inflamed flesh beneath corset laces. Fennell skips over the ceremony. to a scene of Kathy alone at a banquet table where Edward's clingy ward, Isabella, Allison Oliver, gives her the wedding gift of a Kathy doll installed in a dollhouse identical to her new home. Led to her bedroom, Kathy learns its walls were painted to match her skin down to a freckle. Welcome to a uniquely feminized hell. It is Elordi, Gen Z's 6'5" monolith of masculinity, who plays the groom in the third season of HBO's erstwhile teen drama Euphoria, which ages up its high schoolers to early adulthood. Elordi's Nate, a controlling alpha engaged to Sydney Sweeney's hyperfemme Cassie, forbids his wife to work outside their retro suburban home, stranding her amid shag carpeting and yellow wallpaper. This grotesque 50s fantasy dies at their gaudy wedding, which begins with Nate vomiting. Talk of diarrhea and divorce, not joy, brings Cassie to tears walking down the aisle. A gangster creditor crashes the reception, leading her to realize Nate's been lying about his finances and decide the marriage is over before it's begun. Yet the show goes on, from their tacky dance number to the limo ride home. As he's beaten in their living room later that night, she sobs operatically, "It was supposed to be the best day of my life." Maybe the typical wedding remains an exercise in female subjugation and compulsory heterosexuality, but straight women are not the only characters suffering at the altar. As Nate's ordeal implies, masculinity is its own torture chamber. Nowhere is that clearer than in Half Man, Baby Reindeer, creator Richard Gadd's HBO series, steeped in violence, sexual confusion, and dark machismo. It traces the bond between two unrelated men who were raised as brothers, framed by a vicious fight at one of the characters' wedding to another man. Elsewhere, the gendered power imbalance between fiancés echoes a more dramatic disparity in wealth, class, or both. Kathy and Cassie see their husbands as their best chance at securing comfortable lives. FX's love story, John F. Kennedy Jr. and Carolyn Bessette, bewitched a new generation with its tragic fairy tale of a chic commoner whose ascent to American royalty is sealed with an excruciating wedding to which she arrives hours late as paparazzi helicopters circle. Grace's Samara Weaving initiation into high society is gorier in 2019's Ready or Not, set on her wedding night, when her new husband's family of Satan-worshipping aristocrats hunts her in a deadly game of hide-and-seek. This year's sequel climaxes with Grace hijacking her second wedding to a satanic heir by killing him and banishing his oligarchical cabal to hell. Kamala Marone's Rachel is about to save herself from an ancestral curse in Netflix's Something Very Bad Is Going to Happen by marrying her rich fiancé, Adam DeMarco, when he decides her damage is not worth his trouble. The rejection triggers a bloodbath at his parents' massive vacation home. Both horror stories have simple plots but are more complex in their attitudes toward marrying for money or power or security. Grace and Rachel's lives were precarious till they met rich guys. The only problem is fortunes come with moral baggage. They have to surround themselves with exploitative monsters who do not care whether they live or die. What seemed like an ideal mode of survival turns out to be even scarier than eking out an existence on their own. A plush prison, violent death, or the minefield that is independence. You're damned if you say I do, and damned if you don't. It is a bleak vision of adulthood. But as the cost of living soars, the economy further polarizes, and AI eats entry-level jobs, it is not hysterical. Hence the constant reports that young people are anxious, lonely, stressed, hopeless. Last year, a Gallup-Walton Family Foundation study found only 39% of Gen Z adults feel they are thriving, versus 56% of Gen Z middle and high schoolers. What a difference paying your own bills makes. If a wedding is two people's public expression of confidence in their shared future, then it makes sense that the most miserable fictional weddings are striking a chord. For a regular couple intent on beating stacked odds, the sanest option might be to embrace the chaos. The focal point of the drama, a twisted rom-com that shares with Euphoria a star in Zendaya and an arty, youth-focused studio in A24, is another calamitous wedding. This time, there's no great discrepancy in status. Both fiancés are part of the urban, white-collar middle class. Following bride Emma's, Zendaya, confession that she once planned a school shooting, tempers flare, mistrust festers, nasty gossip circulates, and groom Charlie, Robert Pattinson, channels his panic into an abortive hookup with a co-worker. It all comes to a head at the reception, where his bizarre behavior gets him socked in the face. The next thing we know, he's coming home alone, with a bruised face and a blood-stained tux. A red wedding does not have to herald a failed marriage, though. It can be a test for two people who love each other to pass together. The drama ends not in eternal misery, but with Charlie and Emma reuniting, battered and dirty, at a diner. "Do you still live around here?" she asks, still in her gown, but pretending to be a stranger. It is the best gift a person who has screwed up their wedding can receive, a second chance at making a future. That was Red Wedding Season by Judy Berman. Turning the page to Time Off Television, review, Orphan Black star delivers Maximum Pleasure, again by Judy Berman. A great fact checker is a detective interrogating every statement as if it's a case to be solved. No one can get more out of a Google search, but it's offline, doing the timeless shoe leather work of journalism, where they really excel. Often foregoing the glory of a byline, fact checkers serve a purpose nobler than ego, truth. If they were not an endangered species, vanishing from the payrolls of newsrooms in crisis, you would wonder why we so rarely see them in the crime shows that now dominate TV. Maximum Pleasure Guaranteed, an Apple TV series that releases new episodes on Wednesdays, corrects this oversight. With a single mom eking out a living as an excellent but undervalued magazine fact checker for a hero, this witty crime thriller takes its tale of sex work, motherhood, and loneliness in genuinely surprising directions. Yet its fidelity to the truth of each idiosyncratic character makes the show's whiplash narrative feel believable. Tatiana Maslany, who made her versatile reputation playing a dozen clones in Orphan Black, channels all her talent into Pleasure's singular protagonist. Divorced and angling for an overdue promotion, Maslany's Paula is also gearing up for a custody battle. Her ex, Carl, Jake Johnson, impressively devoid of his signature gruff charm, wants to move their daughter, Hazel, Nola Wallace, from New York to Boise with his new partner, Mallory, Jesse Hodges, a polished grown-up who makes the bohemian Paula feel like a mess. The stability the couple can demonstrate relative to her psychological and financial precarity makes her worry they will win. And that's without anyone knowing she's been spending her meager paychecks on sexy video chat sessions with a cam boy, Brandon Flynn's Trevor. Her fear of being exposed becomes suddenly terrifyingly real when their virtual date is interrupted by violence. Paula can only scream and film her screen as a masked man beats and drags away her sex worker confidant. When she reports the abduction, a deadpan police detective, Dolly De Leon, a highlight, informs her that she's likely the real victim of an extortion scam. Sure enough, calls come in threatening to kill Trevor and ruin her life if she does not pay up. When the cops shrug off her tips, Paula must scrutinize the evidence to save not just her reputation, but also her relationship with the child who means everything to her. The most frustrating thing about the preponderance of crime dramas is how flat their characters tend to be. Defined by circumstances more than personality, they're either victims or psycho killers. If we're lucky, we get a brilliant but troubled detective. Yet an unlikely upside to the trend is emerging. Now that just about every show, even comedies, must have some element of crime, writers who care about characters are improving the genre. A veteran of the similarly offbeat but fatally flawed crime shows, Sugar and Hunters, creator David J. Rosen does just that with Pleasure. Maslany is the dynamic center of a story that twists in unexpected directions, giving Paula enough intelligence, warmth, and edginess to make her character cohere. Around her, Rosen builds an ensemble out of well-matched duos, drawn in enough detail to give the series potential beyond its first season. Mallory's ruthlessness in the custody fight begins to alarm wishy-washy Carl. De Leon's jaded but shrewd Gonzalez endures a brasher, greener partner, John Michael Hill. Especially fun is the work-spouse flirtation between Paula's younger colleagues, Jerry, Kiara, Hamagami Goldberg, and Rudy, Charlie Hall. Barbed banter aside, they are more loyal to each other than to Paula, which helps to explain why a woman who once seemed to be the ultimate cool Portland mom is now so lonely in Queens. She pays to confide in a camboy. In a world of symbiotic twosomes, the person who completes her, the one she will never stop fighting for, is Hazel. I'll read just a paragraph of the ocean understory. Biodiversity is the bedrock of resilience, and kelp forests show why. By Tatiana Valletta. At the edge of Cape Town City Lights, one of the ocean's most intricate ecosystems is held together by creatures most people have never seen. Here, beneath the swaying kelp canopy of the great African sea forest, a helmet snail rises from the sand, siphon probing like a periscope for the scent of sea urchins. It disarms their prickly spines with slime and liquefies their innards with acid, keeping the grazers in check and the forest from being devoured. The snail, in turn, must evade the masterful octopus that creeps between the anemone and crusted rocks, while above them sharks prowl through the kelp understory. Between urchin spines, tiny crabs and juvenile abalone take shelter while hungry fish swirl past. Each is part of a living network of interactions. Remove enough strands and the sea forest begins to unravel. Scientists say it is these intricate relationships that allow ecosystems like this to survive a warming ocean, yet they remain dangerously overlooked, even as they die off. The Great African Sea Forest is the world's only sea bamboo forest, a vast underwater jungle stretching over 621 miles from Namibia's desert coast down to the tip of South Africa. We have run out of time for today's episode of Time Magazine, which is generously supported by G. Suggs Insurance, a SureVest insurance group company. They can be reached at gsuggsinsurance.com. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I am Patricia, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Time Magazine is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. The number again is 919-832-5138. No, I am not a robot. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.